All right, thank you. Indeed. So can we save our online freedom? I'm Jaapik Hoepman. I'm from the Radboud University Nijmegen, which is in the east. I also work at TNO in Groningen, which is in the north, and that's why I'm coming from the north, from the ice-cold north. And I do research. I'm a computer scientist in privacy-enhancing technologies and related areas, identity management. And so I have a question for you guys. What do you think? What is the answer? Can we save ourselves online? Do we still have a chance, or are we doomed? Anybody else? All right, so we have mixed voices, which is good, because I bring you a message of hope. I think, yes, we can. And of course, in a talk like this with the current situation, a Obama kind of graphic would be totally inappropriate. That's why Bob the Builder is there. Why do I think there is a chance? Well, first of all, I'm just a hopeless optimistic guy. And of course, we need a Monty Python reference in any talk here. So that's fixed by this. Moreover, I think you actually can change stuff. One of my favorite bands, Die Susan Neubauten, would say that like only half of the world is made of Teflon and asbestos, and the rest can burn, can change. And I think that we can always fight the status quo. We can always fight what's happening now. However, this is not something that we can do all by ourselves. I do believe strongly that in order to do that, we need, you know, to join hands, both in the sense of, you know, people joining, people like us, people here present joining, but also people's communities. So people from, say, more usability design, people from more technology-oriented, politicians, and all kinds of people. It's not only just technologists. I mean, and that's one of the things that I'm going to talk about in this talk a bit more. So that will come back. First of all, if you wanted to have the short version, this is the short version, so you can go. I think the rain stopped. And I need to get rid of this cord. That sucks. That's better. So now the long version starts. So now I'm going to argue why I think we can save ourselves. First of all, if you want to say something about what you can save, you have to say what you have to save. So you have to define the problem. And one of the first things, of course, is to define what is online freedom. And I will focus most of the time on privacy, because that's really the core of my research topic. And of course, then the first question is, what is privacy? And one of the main scholars in this area once said, it's impossible to define, and I guess I agree in a bit. If you look at the history of privacy research, you really see different kinds of definitions being thrown around. The first definition from the 18th century was the right to be let alone. And then afterwards, there was this idea, when the database came up, the idea of informational self-determination, the idea that you, as the owner of your personal data, should have control about how this information is spread and how it is used. This is one view. Then there was another view, which really is more the view of what is personal information, that relates it more to what is identity. This is the definition that privacy is really there to free you from any unreasonable constraints to construct your own identity. So this stresses much more the lack of interference part, whereas the second definition is much more about the control part. And then the last one is by Helen Nissenbaum, which focuses on context, which really focus on the fact that information from one context should not be just flowing to another context, because then it can be misinterpreted, misused, abused, and then context separation is really the thing that you want to achieve by having proper privacy protection. So that's more in the definition part. Of course, privacy is not and is many things. Me being a computer scientist, I'm just a dumb hat, and I just, you know, interpreted privacy as data protection. I just consider information, and there's of course many more aspects of privacy that I won't talk about. But if you talk about information, it is very, very important in the context of data protection and in the context of this talk to realize that there's different kinds of information. And there's information that you give away. This is the explicit information. This is information you put on Twitter. This is information you put on your social network profile. This is information that you enter in a Google search query, for instance. So this is the kind of stuff that you're aware of. This is usually something that you're aware of, that you reveal that kind of information. But there's other information. That is the implicit information. This is the information that is observed by all the services that you use while you are not really aware of the fact that they actually observe this. You're not really aware of the fact that they collect this information. It's the things like if you go to a website and there happens to be a Facebook like button, that Facebook then knows that you're visiting that website. It's the fact that if you go from, enter a search query in Google, and then if you click on a search result, they actually will record which search result you clicked in order to improve their service. If you have like the large scale online courses like Coursera, they collect a lot of information about you when you enter a course, when they view the course, when you do the course homework, which kind of questions you answer, how you answer them, that kind of stuff. That's a huge profile, a behavioral profile of yourself, that in fact is in a way much, much more revealing than the explicit information that you give. It's like for in psychology, it's really an obvious fact. I mean, what people say, people can say whatever they want, but what they do is actually, you know, really telling about their motivations, really telling about themselves. And that is this observed information. And then, of course, there's inferred information. That's information that's derived from that. And I think the most worrisome part of the situation in that we are in now is that there's so much observed information being collected over which we have little control and over which we and about which we really know very little. Okay, that's all well and dandy. Why should we care anyway? Why is it important? And I guess I'm preaching for the choir here, because most of the people will argue, yeah, it's important. Yeah, right? I mean, who disagrees here? Let's check. See, there you go. But still, I want to make this really very, very, very clear. Because there is a lot of misconception, especially when you talk to the general public about the importance of privacy, they really tend to think this is a very personal right. And what I really want to argue here and bring across here is that it's a societal right. And partly you see that already in these moral bases for data protection, for privacy that you see here. Like, you know, information-based harm is really something that can happen. And this is still a personal thing. But if you go to the prevention of information equality, you already see that this is something that is needed to restore a certain power balance between those people that have more information and those people that have little information. Things like prevention of informational injustice. This is the spheres of privacy. Then you get back to the whole concept of context separation. And this is really an important topic, the respect for moral autonomy. And the fact that privacy really protects your autonomy and protects your ability to think for yourself, to think through certain concepts, to construct your identity, to maybe challenge the status quo, maybe think about certain things that in the current political environment are not really all that well understood, or maybe are actually actively repressed. Think about gay rights in Russia or other kind of rights in other countries. If you go to East Germany like 20, 30 years ago, these kind of things were really, really important. And therefore, I would argue that privacy really is a societal value. It's really there to restore the power balance between, on the one hand, government, and on the other hand, ourselves. And because it creates a space where there's freedom of thought and freedom of discussion, it's really an important value that you need in order to have a democratic society. I mean, without the discussion, democracy is really dead. And for those people that think that we really don't have anything to hide, here is a lot of reasons why we do have stuff to hide. Everybody has something to be embarrassed about. There's even the assumption that the problem is the data that you want to hide. The thing is that even innocent data can harm you. There's freedom of thought. And there's this thing that, I mean, what is the distinction between stuff that is illegal and stuff that just happens to be inconvenient And maybe there's stuff that happens to be inconvenient now that's going to be illegal next year. You don't know. If the data is stored now, you will be haunted by it later. If you happen to smoke marijuana when you were a kid, you can forget becoming the president of the USA, for instance. Depending probably on whether you're a guy or a woman, I'm afraid. I mean, there is this thing. And then the question, of course, what is this data used for anyway? I mean, data that you voluntarily give for certain innocent purposes is suddenly used for all kinds of stuff. There's a recent case here in the Netherlands where the tax authorities went to the parking a company that registered parking rights. Basically, the idea was that you would enter your license plate in a machine, and then this would say that you paid for parking at a certain space, and this was stored by this company. And then the tax office went there to check whether people that have lease cars actually filed their tax declaration in the right way. So data that was only needed to check whether you paid for parking actually is used to see whether you do tax evasion or not. This is really function creep. So, you know, it's really a wrong assumption. The point is not that there's data that is a priori wrong or illegal. The point is that innocent data can later be used wrongly. Or, in the words of this famous Cardinal Richelieu, give me 6 sentences of any man and I can find him hanged. And this is similar to a remark that Moxie Marlinspark recently made in a blog post, that there's so many laws in the US that probably any US citizen violates at least one of them. So, and then what you do. So, in to summarize, what is the important bit about privacy? You have to have the right storyline. And I think the wrong storyline will be the Big Brother storyline. Especially if you want to convince the government official, if you want to convince the average white guy that privacy is an important right, then Big Brother is not the right message, because he's in general not worried about this stuff. He generally thinks that the government is okay, and in any case, government officials themselves will really think that they're okay, so they don't really see the problem if you talk about Big Brother. Sweet sister, little sister. This is not about government, that's more about businesses. Businesses collecting data, Amazon giving you recommendations, Spotify giving you recommendations, Facebook doing all kinds of nice stuff to your data, making your life easier. Yes, there are risks there, but most of the people actually like those services. So that's also not a good storyline. I personally prefer the storyline of The Trial, the book by Franz Kafka, where in the beginning of the book, the main character in the book is charged of a crime, but then he's not told what the crime is, and he's not told why he's charged with a crime, and then the remainder of the book, he is in search of what the fuck happened here, and how can I clear my name? And this is actually what happens if you don't have enough privacy. If data about you is used in different contexts, is abused in different contexts, and then at a certain point, a decision is made about you without you knowing that this decision is made, without you being able to challenge that decision. Okay, so we have established that this is important. And then why is it so hard to get this right? Well, for one thing, this personal information is worth money. There's many companies like Facebook, like Google, like all these advertisement companies that collect profiles about us. And the problem is here with the business models. It's not that we, as customers of, say, Facebook, are buying a service and then we're the customers of Facebook. No, it's more like we're the product of Facebook. Facebook is selling us as an audience to anybody else. I mean, it's just like saying that pigs of a pig farm are customers of the pig farm. It's not really like that, right? So that's a problem. It's a business model problem. It's a business perspective. That really makes it really, really hard to change stuff. Because from the business perspective, it makes sense to collect all this data. They really want that. There's another problem related to more general to the problem of freedom of information, freedom online. There's the issue of silos. Companies like Facebook and Google really want to keep you as a customer within their service. So they really have an incentive to build a silo, to build a walled garden, to make it impossible for you to connect to a Google Circles friend if you're on Facebook. So this, you know, really, you know, makes these silos, really builds up big walls within the internet, really makes the thing much less open than it could be. Thirdly, there's centralization. This is really related to this business model thing, but it's more general. You really see, if you look at any kind of IT infrastructure, for some strange reason, whereas the internet started as a distributed system, there was no single point of control, everything really moves to centralization. Everything really moves to a centralized point of control. And this is really worrisome, because that means that all the data is in one place. Fourth point, fear. Many of the arguments that are being told to us about, okay, why do we need all this information collection, is related to stories about security. We need to do this to make the society more secure. And this is not actually something that only politicians say. It's actually the people say that. The people really want security. If something happens, like a few years ago, there was a case of a young girl that got abused and in the end died, which is really a horrible incident. But as a response, there was a really direct demand to politics saying, okay, you have to do something to make sure that this never ever happens again. And politics by nature wants to say, okay, we're going to make sure that this never ever ever happens again. And then they have to think of something to do this. And then one of the natural things to do is to, you know, increase security, collect more information, and this way maybe hope to make sure that these things don't happen again. These are the mechanisms. These are the things that make it so hard to get this right. And then there was this guy, I think now a month and a half ago, giving us all this, you know, background information how the National Security Agency in the US is really collecting a lot of information about not only European citizens but also American citizens. And of course, in the US, the discussion is only about the American citizens. The fact that we're in Europe screwed is not really their concern. That's a separate issue. Still, this stuff is happening. And what this actually showed, that the fact that a security agency is collecting a lot of information about us is not that surprising. What is surprising is the fact that instead of building the collection systems themselves, they are actually using private companies to do the collection of information and then go knocking on the door, say, hey, look, you've got good information that we can actually use. Give it to us. That makes it much, much more harmful. The surveillance is really ubiquitous. There's no oversight. Yeah, there's a court. It's a secret court. You don't know what they do. So there's no transparency whatsoever. And this, what is really also really concerning in this is that really the powers that be, the people into power, really want to keep that status quo, really want to keep that system like that. They really don't want to open up, which I think is really, really worrisome. And I think actually what they did is they really blew trust in a big way. If you replace any piece of text, the word USA or America with the word China, then most of the Americans would actually, American politicians especially, would understand what we would mean. But for some strange reason, we used to trust this, but this is getting less and less and less. And this is too bad. So, I started saying, yes, we can. I started to being optimistic, and I think the temperature in this room is going down and down. It's like chilly, and I see like very doomy, gloomy faces here. So people start thinking, like, can we really stop this? Well, I think we can. And to show you an analogy from that something that started in say the 50s, 60s, is the area of environmental pollution. this situation really used to be very, very bad. There used to be pollution everywhere. All factories, whatever, they would pollute whatever they could. Why would they do that? Well, because, you know, pollution was an externality. I mean, why would you do something with your waste if you can just get away with it, dumping it anywhere freely? But at some point, we as a society realized that this was an issue, realized that something had to change. And therefore, environmental laws came into effect. The pollution became an internality. It became actually a cost for companies that they really had to reckon with. And we're moving to more cleaner forms of energy. And I'm not saying that we're there yet. Far from it. But it's really different from where we were like 30 years ago. And I think the same goes for, say, the state of privacy and internet freedom that we have now. It's not that because the system is as it is now, and it's not that because the systems have been designed the way they are now, that we cannot change them and make them different and make the mechanisms behind them different. So, what can we do? What should we do in order to change this? Well, first and foremost, I think a mindset has to change. A mindset of especially the Western societies to accept that there's risk in living. It's like the sign that says on the smoking package, like smoking kills. Yeah, well, living kills. Live with it. I mean, you know, you cannot, I mean, and even if you would want, you know, total security, I know the perfect solution. You know, put a lock on the outside of every front door and lock it. Lock everybody in. Then you have perfect security. But then that's not a society that I personally would want to live in. So this is something that we really have to reconsider. Secondly, governments, on behalf of their citizens, really should think about making privacy an internal cost. Secondly, require this openness and transparency. I mean, yes, you have processes to investigate crimes. Yes, you have processes to see if there's terrorists around. But be open and transparent about these processes and make sure that we, as society, can do exercise our rights and can actually do the checks and balances that are required for that. Third, in order to break up these silos, to make sure that the technology is much more open and connected, just outlaw this silo kind of behavior. I mean, me as a computer scientist, I'm totally frustrated by all this web-based stuff, RSS and stuff. We used to have NNTP, and there was like free information flow. I mean, it sort of pisses me off. Last but not least, outlaw certain business models. And this is really, not, I mean, to put this in a very extreme like framework, you know, we used to have slavery and people thought that was a nice business. But at some point we said, this is a business model that is, you know, ridiculous. Get rid of it. We don't do that anymore. You know, so this is not a totally outlandish thought. But that's not all. Because, I mean, we cannot really trust government to clean itself. We cannot really trust government to do all of this by itself. We can also do stuff as a society, as system builders, as system designers, as hackers, as technologists, to make the systems inherently more privacy-friendly and secure. And this is really motivated by this whole concept of code as law. The fact that how you design systems really has an impact on how these systems can be used. This is depending on the design of, for instance, Facebook or Twitter. It's easier or less easy for any kind of agency to get at the data that they are collecting. You know, at the best, they would have no data that they could get, right? And that's because I really think that just as technology is actually the source of the problem, that also means by redesigning the technology, by applying things like privacy by design, you can actually twist that technology around. You can really make it different. But to really have the impact that we want, and this is really the important thing, and I really liked Nadim's talk this afternoon here about CryptoCat, where he also stresses this, is that you really have to make all this technology really user-friendly. The reason people use Facebook, the reason people use Google Calendar, the reason people use Twitter is because it's very user-friendly. It really is something that people want to use. So in terms of functionality, you really have to make it as good as those systems. That's of paramount importance. I mean, I myself also use these kind of systems because it's like so much easier than trying to convince everybody to use CryptoCat or trying to convince everybody to use like a good system, a cloud system like TeamDrive. I will talk a little bit about that later. You're sort of like forced to go with the majority, and you're really forced to go with the systems that give much less protection. And one of the things that I would really love to discuss with you guys is this whole idea what Nassim also coined, is the idea of trivializing security. Really make it, you know, it's secure. You don't have to do anything for it. It is just secure. You know, it's really different from having to remember fingerprints, doing stuff with PGP keys, being aware of the security. That makes it too hard for people to use. So can we really make security trivial? And by extension, can we make privacy trivial? Because like I said, there is good sources of inspiration, at least from the technical perspective, what you can do. In terms of communication, we have CryptoCat, we have Tor. In terms of searching, we have things like DuckDuckGo, XQuick, but there's a few. In terms of authentication or authorization, there's a fun, cool project that we're working on at the University of Nijmegen, which is called IRMA, where IRMA stands for I Reveal My Attributes, which is all about attribute-based credentials, which is all about being able to prove that you're over 18 without revealing your full identity. So this is really, you know, giving authentication, giving authorization, but doing that in a much more privacy-friendly way than, you know, revealing your full identity online. There is storage and cloud providers. There's things like TeamDrive, there's SpiderOak, and there's the least authority file system, which is really like a peer-to-peer file system. But still, it's, you know, for specific users, it's too hard to use. And this is when I get to the end of this talk, and I really would like to enter into discussion with you guys, because that's really the point. There's a few things that really annoy me here if I think about this, and this is something that triggers me, and this is something that really makes me want to work on this issue. One thing, for instance, is social networks. Why is it that for every kind of social network, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, I need to keep separate contacts? I want to have one network, and then I want to have the functionality over that network, you know, on top of that. So I have one contact list, in a way, and I can Twitter with them, and I can, you know, tell them whether they can actually access certain parts of Facebook. Why should I have separate contact lists in every application? That sucks. Second, peer-to-peer cloud service, but really in the sense that, okay, I buy a hard disk, external hard disk. My mom buys an external hard disk. That may actually be very unlikely, I don't know. But let's suppose that she actually would do that. She would be able to plug it in, and then she would be part of a worldwide cloud. And whenever she would, you know, store data, it would be replicated, it would be secure. Nobody else but her would be able to access it, unless she wants to share, for instance, pictures of her holiday with her grandchildren. And that should be trivial for her to do. How about modularity? Why should it be the case that whenever I use Office products, the only thing I can do is actually store the stuff on SkyDrive? That sucks. I mean, you want open APIs. You want to be able to say, okay, this is the software I use, and then I use this other component that I freely choose, and that I want to interconnect. That means openness of APIs. This is an important thing. And then there's things like, okay, make collaboration software, make social networking much more privacy friendly than they are now, but still make them as usable as they are now. And it was the context of peer-to-peer, I happened to be at the talk of Stephen Pemberton. There were very few people there in the big tent. It was like almost a shame, about the future of the web. And there was one thing that was really interesting that he said, that HTTP is really a bad protocol these days for doing web traffic. because it really, you know, if you're a popular site, you have a big problem. You get too much load and stuff. So he was actually arguing for a peer-to-peer kind of HTTP. So I thought that was sort of like, okay, in sync in a way with some of the ideas that I'm trying to tell you here. But like I said, this is something that I cannot do alone. This is not something that you can do alone. This is something that we actually should do together. And one of the first things I think that we should do together is actually define how to do that and discuss about how to make those steps. And that was one of the reasons for me to give this presentation, to get that discussion started. So I hope I triggered that in your heads. And I'm open for questions and remarks or whatever. Take it away.
It's not working.
Which channel are you on?
Take this one.
And then people have to shout from the back.
Yeah, well, then I don't need this one. If people shout from the back, just shout your questions. This mic is gonna need that.
Okay, yeah, I see some hands. Do you want to do the ordering or should I do it? You do it. Okay, good. I'll try to repeat the question, okay?
How do you plan to overcome the social inertia? Because people are in certain areas where they feel fine. How do you want to get them out and make sure that they are in friendly places?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think the only way to actually make... There's two ways to make that happen. The first and foremost, you actually have to offer a service that's better than what they have now. That's how normal competition works, and that's why Hives is now almost dead in the Netherlands. And there's probably like similar examples all over the world. The second one is that as privacy becomes a more important topic, it is going to be one of those aspects that people are willing to consider when using a certain product. And of course, it's first going to be the more privacy-aware people that use certain services. But you do see a certain like a threshold effect that after a certain threshold, more and more people use it. And one of the things that I think is important, like a mechanism in whatever you design, is somehow make it possible for the new system to interconnect with the old system. So for instance, say, if you would like to design a social network replacement of Facebook, the first functionality it should have is interface with Facebook. Because that means that if you switch to the new network, you don't lose your friends. Yeah? It's a mechanism, it's a trick.
Facebook will never provide that.
I absolutely agree. That is absolutely a problem. That's something that you really have to try to circumvent or work around. And of course, then they will try to stop you from that, and that's going to be a battle for quite some time. Maybe that's an effort that you want to take to make sure that you actually have a chance of doing that. But it's not the only mechanism, right? It's just a suggestion of a mechanism that might work.
Okay. You mentioned outlawing business models, and you gave an example that I didn't really understand. It was about slavery.
Yeah.
In the end, it was not so much the business model of trading slaves that was outlawed, but owning another life that was outlawed in the end.
Well, isn't that a business? I mean, it's related to a business model. I mean,
regardless of that, I mean, what kind of business model is it that you would like to outlaw? In the end, Facebook provides the service for free. I mean, we are the product, and some people choose might or might not choose to do that. I mean, you might not do it. Your next door neighbor might think it's a great idea.
No, but
and they're willing to trade.
That's true. But therefore, the example of say environmental law is an important one. The point is that for each individual, the cost is probably very low. The same with pollution. In a way, the cost of each individual polluter is probably low. But adding up all the pollution actually, you know, incurs a cost. And therefore, this is the reason why at some point it was made sure that the cost of pollution was internalized, and the privacy infringement, the decrease of privacy, also incurs a cost. It's hard for us to actually imagine this cost. It's hard for us to calculate this cost. So that's something that we have to think about. But if we know ways to do that, we actually have to make sure that Google pays this cost and not us.
But there is, I mean, you find there's a high cost in, I mean, that Facebook knows everything and that your some of your information is shared. Mm-hmm. But there might be some other people that have a different, say, look, I mean, I don't have any money. I mean, I live in Africa, I make $1 a day. I mean, you might care about your privacy in the Netherlands, but if I get a free online network that can send me messages, I mean, sure, you can know everything about me. I mean, I'm not saying good. I mean, I'm not judging, but there's, I mean, you I know, might, for you, there's a cost. For somebody else, it might be a benefit.
No, but like for instance, actually some recent discussion here in the Netherlands is about I don't know the English word. Inentingen. Anybody? Vaccination. Thank you. Vaccination is actually something that you would like to mandate in order to prevent the spread of dangerous diseases. So even if certain individuals that actually don't care, you still would want to, force that. So there are cases where actually you would prevent individuals from certain behavior that for them personally is rational, but is not rational at a societal scale. So that is, and this is a debate. I mean, this is.
Sorry,
I think
there's
so.
There's some more questions in the room.
Let's take this offline then. Yeah, I think it's good.
Okay, since a lot of stuff on the web is business driven and there's always this business model going on and everything needs to fit the model, how do you see that happening for open APIs? As in, there have been open APIs for several things, but businesses choose not to use it because it doesn't fit their advertising business model. Mm-hmm. And even if they do use it, they pick only those parts that don't interfere with their advertising and their profiling stuff. So how could you have an incentive for these businesses? I don't think we can change the law. So is there anything else?
Well, do you have your own suggestion? I mean, if you tie both my hands and my feet together and then say, okay, can you do something? Then probably I can't.
Perhaps you do think that the law can be changed.
Well, I think I do believe that certain things can be regulated by law, and you can easily change them technologically speaking.
So I was wondering, outlawing some business models may be a solution, but only when outlawing actually does work. So why I'm asking this is because Google was merging its privacy policies.
Yep.
The European Data Protection Authority looked at it and said, okay, this is breaking the law, you should revert it.
Yep.
And then what happened? Google said, let's ignore it, just go ahead.
Yeah, it's a matter of, of course. So, I mean, outlawing anything doesn't really help unless you enforce it. And, the enforcing has really something to do with, in the end, if society really wants a world where these business models prevail, where society really wants pervasive surveillance, then that's what society will get.
Sorry, we'll take a question here.
Yeah, I have a question about I reveal my attributes, because I think it's a very interesting approach.
Yeah.
Because in a certain sense, I think that the web has killed the internet in a sense that you used to have like email, Usenet, and there were certain services were inherent in the technology. And now you have Facebook offering chat, offering fora, offering everything, and offering also its own authentication model. So yep. I think that's one of the problems. You have a company offering a whole set of features and just by accident using something called the internet. So you think it would be interesting, maybe you wouldn't have to outlaw anything, but maybe go back to the protocol and really try to create this transparent privacy inside the protocol. I'm really talking about reinventing like something like SMTP, email protocols, something to really create security from the from the ground up.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I really like the way you summarize how the web killed the internet. I mean, that sort of summarizes my whole talk, I guess. Yes, I mean, you want to go back to the bare bones protocols that were inherently open and inherently made it easy for the information to flow and were inherently transparent. And that's what we're getting at. The problem is that for businesses, the current incentives structure is such that centralization, walled gardens, and all this kind of stuff is where it ends up. Technologically speaking, we can offer alternatives. I mean, it's in a way trivial to implement a peer-to-peer Facebook. Technologically speaking, that's trivial. It's just that Facebook will never do it because then they don't get this observed data. So you have to change the incentive structure for these companies in general in society in order to make this change happen. That's the point. And then we have to have a discussion about how to change the incentive structure.
Well, first of all, I think you're right when you said you were preaching to the choir, but still, like the other people, I would like to pick on that one detail I don't agree with and not talk about the 99% I agree with. What struck me in the example you gave about contact lists is that I think it's a really nerdy idea that contacts exist without context. When I go to my weekly meeting of my knitting club, I behave in a different way than here or at work or actually I'm not a member of knitting club. But
I'm disappointed. I mean,
even my name there might be different. So. And these different silos, these different social networks, they kind of emulate these different spheres we live in and the different identities we have. So, yeah, so that's one thing I just didn't agree with.
Yeah, okay, I see your point. But and I guess it's a way of how to model then the contact list in a way. But in say the earlier practice, you would have like one Rolodex for basically all your contacts, right? I mean, you would not have like 10 different Rolodexes for your 10 different contacts. Contexts. So that's what I'm getting at. And I really perceive it as a problem in a way, a friction. These days, if you have if you're in several social networks and actually have shared connections on these several social networks, it's like a mess. At least personally for me, that feels unnatural. And in general, I think it's like the network functionality. The network really should be decoupled from the functionality, much like it was a mistake from the phone companies to actually have like phone. Be not only a service but also the network. Like the phone network was both the service and the network, and that's why they totally didn't understand the internet.
So I have one question myself as a sure. moderator. Two things. First of all, there's a big difference I think in fighting climate
one
change.
Question. One, only one you said.
Good one. I'll stick to one. Let me think. Okay, there's one that's really important. The NSA is scraping data and saying, seeing on slides of Snowden that they will keep data that's encrypted for a more longer time.
Yeah.
Having just heard the stories about Bluffdale, big data centers going on.
Yeah.
A lot of your solutions depend on strong encryption.
No.
Well, if your mother is going to buy an external hard drive and she depends on other people's hard drives to make a cloud, you'll need encryption for that. But what my question would be, what is your belief in encryption?
Well, let me answer this in two ways. First, I don't think that the examples that I give, the security totally rests on encryption. I think it also rests on the fact that a lot of stuff is distributed. So in order to get it, you have to spend much more effort to get it because you have to go to all these different locations. Even in the peer-to-peer file system, the chunks are not on every hard drive. They are on certain hard drives. And if you haven't broken the encryption yet, you will have a very hard time figuring out which hard drives they are. So you actually have to go and get all the hard drives. So you really increase the amount of work that an NSA has to do in order to get at the data. So that's one part of the question. In terms of trusting the crypto, there's no cryptographer in the world that trusts the crypto for more than, say, 20 to 50 years. And it's really an open research question to make crypto that can withstand that stands unattacked for at least 100 years. This is an open question. There's no solution for that.
Thank you. Are there any more questions? No? Okay. Well, thank you. Oh, here's one.
Thanks. One consideration. You don't believe that instead of try to push some law to make outlaw business model, it's possible that a medium to large community like a school or a public agency will start their own webmail, their own social network in order to give to their employee or their subjugate the access to the internet and guarantee the respect of the law of their national country, instead expose their employee to the foreign services, in example.
You mean you refer to the fact that lots of universities move to Gmail and that kind of stuff?
That is an example, but start to think if everyone should be able to set up their own webmail or their own social network that is able to cooperate with other social network, but it's guaranteed that the user stays separated from other country, in example.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, I mean, one of the things that you could do to make the situation more secure is to have like regional kind of clouds. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hank, thank you very much for having this talk.
You're welcome.
Warm applause.